how do you get an athlete to listen to your message that you're doing too much before it's too late?
In the extreme cases, you have to threaten to not want to see them anymore. And in some cases, just dismiss them, which I've had to do with some very good athletes. And it was sad. I wasn't willing to sacrifice my philosophy just to keep them on as a potentially great athlete.
Welcome to the Athlete's Compass podcast. Each week, renowned sports scientist and founder of Athletica AI, Dr. Paul Larson, athlete, coach, and sports scientist Mariana Rakai, and coach and cyclist Paul Warlowski discuss training, racing, and improving your health and fitness. Get ready for your journey to peak performance.
Hello and welcome to the Athlete's Compass podcast, where we navigate training, fitness, and health for everyday athletes. We are honored today to talk with a special guest, Dr. Phil Maffetone. Paul has talked about him often on this show. Dr. Maffetone is a renowned figure in endurance sports, celebrated for his holistic approach to health and performance. With a background in human biology and chiropractic, along with certifications in physiotherapy, Chinese medicine, and kinesiology, Dr. Maffetone has been a pioneer in integrating various disciplines to optimize athletic performance and overall well-being. Dr. Maffetone, we are so grateful you could be with us today. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. It's really great to be with you.
You have talked a lot about athletes being fit but unhealthy and wrote an article with Dr. Larson called The Athletes Fit But Unhealthy back in 2016. Can you explain what this means for everyday endurance athletes?
Sure. It's a very important concept, but it's even more important to put into practice. And basically, it's that we don't want to push our training to compete better, thinking that we're going to compete better at the expense of our health. In other words, we don't want to sacrifice our health to be better athletes. And it may seem logical, but it's not applied because people are hearing so much stuff about training, and especially the latest thing, the latest hype. And a lot of it's no pain, no gain related, or a lot of it is some narrow piece of research that shows that if you sprint every day as fast as you could, you're going to get better. Yeah, that's true. After a week, you might get better if you take a rest day at least. But, you know, we need to look at the whole picture, like you mentioned, Paul. We need to look holistically at what's going on, not just right now, but this week, this month, and the rest of our lives, how it's going to influence us.
The article from 2016 really hit home for me because I totally adopted the no pain, no gain philosophy, and the harder I could train, the better, until my body said stop. So as Paul, Dr. Larson knows, I was the figure, the girl in the picture in the fit but unhealthy article.
Yes.
I didn't really appreciate health, like performance, health over performance concept before actually prof started coaching me after I came back from overtraining. So how do we as everyday athletes even get into this deep hole of overtraining?
I mean, there's a lot of reasons why people do what they do. One of them I mentioned, the hype socially that we get from the media. So the running magazines, the triathlete magazines, they push this hype about more is better, more miles, harder miles, and So it's not just in sports, it's our whole society that has developed this notion that's just outright wrong, that we need to work harder to be better. And as Bill Bowerman said, that's garbage. It's the athlete who's most intelligent in that approach that benefits the most. And this was not foreign to me, although when I first got into practice and started working with athletes, it was so clear because there were the athletes in front of me who were sacrificing their health for more fitness. And it was hard to even talk to them about it because the concepts, the philosophy they had was so ingrained in them. Even the ones who relied on their training partners to decide what kind of program they were going to follow, what kind of workout they were going to have that day, as if their training partners were the experts. And so, I had to really emphasize that this was important, often to the point where I said, look, I can't work with you anymore if you're going to keep running yourself into the ground. And indeed, I would eventually start dismissing patients, athletes who I started working with, because they couldn't implement those ideas, and so I didn't want to. I had seen enough athletes who had injuries, for example. They'd come see me, and most of those injuries were easy to treat, and the athlete would feel better. Then they'd go out and run themselves into the ground more and get the same injury back, or maybe a new one. And so it didn't take long to connect the dots and say, you need to think about this differently. And it's really what got me into coaching, because I realized that if they had a coach, it was not somebody that was applying this philosophy. And so I wanted to intervene and say, okay, I'm going to help coach you. I was in early, even before that, I was early on asking athletes, asking people who trained in whatever sport to bring in their diary. And if they didn't have one, to start keeping a diary. So I would always look at that. And then I would look at the person and say, well, what I'm seeing in you and what I see in your diary just doesn't match. You're not able to do these things. And so therefore, you need to change it. And therefore I became the coach at that point.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I've just got a quick question. Mariana, can you maybe answer your own question a little bit and take yourself back to the mindset that you had maybe before you met me? And then of course the info that I was giving you was simply the info that Phil taught me. So what will you be that younger person and, okay. And less experienced person? What were you thinking?
So just quick background. I wanted to do my first Ironman. I had one half Ironman under my belt and just moved from Canada to Dubai. And I gave myself a 9 months to train for this Ironman. I mean, I was pretty new to triathlon, especially long distance triathlon. And I went into it to qualify for Kona, which at that time, that was 2019. So that was hard for women to do. Like I would basically have to win. And so I went in with the mindset that I'm going to Kona. This is it. And because kids were at school, I had 6 hours to basically to train every day, plus my work, what I was doing coaching. So I went in, every training session was like I was preparing for Olympics. Like I was all in. I was raised as an athlete, and I've carried it with me all my life. So it was a little bit of that, you know, no pain, no gain mentality for months. But I was taking my, like, for example, this is to just describe my basic level, 90K bike ride was a long ride for me. So I had to take myself from pretty low level to high level quickly. Like 9 months, it sounds like a long time for everyday athlete, but it's for training from Ironman, it's not. 9 months goes fast, right? So I would train, push myself hard, and then pick up kids. Sometimes I was so trashed. And then when I was walking to the school and get the kids, then three kids, they have all kinds of activities, you know, supper, you know, get everything done in the house. It was like nonstop. There were no time to chill. if I could squeeze in a nap, that was excellent. And then I would like get up and go get the kids groggy and, you know, full on kid stuff afterwards. So it was, there was no rest, basically. But what I didn't realize that training is not just about muscle, heart, lungs, you know, the stuff that we can all see. Like you can feel muscle soreness. You can feel your muscles getting stronger. You can feel your fitness level getting high or higher, but you don't like recognize and give value to the tiredness. So I think like looking back, I sort of respected that tiredness that I carried, but I totally just ignored it and like tried to will myself through everything. This race is so important to me that I can do this even though I'm tired and exhausted. So I gave no thought on the important part, which is the overall life stress, right? And how I felt in my body, because I would just will myself through it. So that my biggest mistake was that ignoring the exhaustion.
Yeah, you know, people don't understand that fatigue, muscle fatigue, with the soreness that we see, is associated with muscle weakness. And with muscle weakness, we have to recover more. With muscle weakness, we have muscle imbalance typically, so our gait becomes irregular. And it's a domino effect that can be devastating. But what you say is a common thing, especially in age group athletes who are working typically a full-time job. And often have families, and they can't see that big picture. They can only see their training log that they're going to fill out and, you know, going out and meeting the group for the long ride or whatever. And that, you know, you had to keep reeling people in because they had so much else to do in their life. With work and family and social obligations that were part of it, and you can't ignore those things.
You know, you Dr. Maffetone and Paul have both sounded the alarm on this, that you know this training stress isn't just physical, and I think Mariana's story really brings this up. How do you get an athlete to listen to your message that you're doing too much before it's too late?
Yeah, early on it was more difficult because nobody knew who I was, and so they weren't coming to see me and having to wait a while. And I was not the expert. I was just, you know, some guy who was going to help fix their knee. But I think being firm about it and educating them and talking about the brain and the you know, the stress hormones. And sometimes that goes over their head, but it gives them a sense that, you know, somebody's thinking logically about this. And then in the extreme cases, you have to threaten to not want to see them anymore. And in some cases, just dismiss them, which I've had to do with some very good athletes. And it was sad to let them go, but I didn't have any other choice. I wasn't willing to sacrifice my philosophy to keep them on as a potentially great athlete.
I think it's hard to get the buy-in when the message is not no pain, no gain. What do you think, Prof? Was it hard to get a buy-in from me? Or I think I was at the point where I had exhausted every other solution, like every other method. I had nowhere to go anymore.
I think you're right. I think like sometimes you have to hit rock bottom, right, before you're willing to kind of crawl out of that and see that, you know, I think someone said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting, you know, a different response, right? So, once you've kind of reached that level, then you gotta look elsewhere. And that's when you actually listen and then you make a plan to do something different and then look at that response to the different thing. And then lo and behold, you know, you eventually started to feel the power, right? When your heart rate finally settled and your pace improved at the same heart rate, which is the perfect segue to what we want to talk about next. Like, Phil, can you please describe the MAF method in general?
Well, I think the method begins with the philosophy that health and fitness are together and they need to stay balanced. And as we build fitness, we need to build our health to maintain that balance. What I added to that were some tools that people could use on their own, which has always been my philosophy from going back to when I was a student. I don't want to have to give people a cookbook to follow or a diet to follow. I want to give them the tools so they can do that themselves. I want to work myself out of a job. And so when they have these tools, they will know that, for example, what they're doing is working, because a good tool like heart rate gives you feedback fairly quick if you're applying everything correctly. So you don't have to wait until your next race or your next two or three races. So those tools included things like the 180 formula, the 2-week test where people get rid of junk food and reduce their natural carbohydrate intake for a 2-week period, monitor their signs and symptoms from before to after that 2-week period. Now they could feel what it's like for their metabolism to change and see those signs and symptoms, some of them or all of them, disappear. And other tools that you know, that in many cases they're biofeedback oriented tools, which was I used biofeedback in other ways, and the heart rate relationships, heart rate variability, resting heart rate, all these things they're biofeedback tools that people, if they have the correct technology, or if they have the technology and use it correctly, they can educate themselves, they can understand better, and they can apply these things with greater confidence. And it only takes one race. When you say to somebody, hey, I know you've been training this way up till now, and you've done well, but you've burned yourself out several times, you're injured all the time, and your health is suffering, you could actually race better without injuring, without all the health problems that you've developed, and actually train you. And when you say, okay, we'd like to train you at a slow pace, a low heart rate for 4 to 6 months before you do any speed work, and then jump into a race to see where you're at. And a high proportion of those people run a personal best if it's like a 10K or a half marathon where you have better the better ability to compare. It gets their attention. And so mm-hmm. that's an important tool as well.
Yeah. There's so much to unpack in that statement there, Phil, but just back to the Athletica for a moment, and for Athletica listeners, this is what we've created. Ultimately, we've created these tools for you. So heart rate variability analysis, that's embedded now within the Athletica platform. So you can actually look at, your overall balance of sympathetic and sympathetic stress and parasympathetic recovery dominance. We have Phil's 180 formula embedded within every test week in every sport across the Athletica platform. Right. So, and again, a lot of people kind of complain, well, why aren't you using that data to, refine my zones and these things? That work is coming. But for now, just like Phil said, this remains as a tool for you to be able to get insight into your own levels of power or pace relative to that heart rate. And that will change depending on lifestyle habits and depending on training health ultimately. And over to Mariana next, because Mariana, you had the experience that Phil just described.
Yeah, just everything just, felt so much better, better energy, better brain power, everything. But I also did what you just mentioned, this 4 to 6 weeks, 4 to 6 months of easy training. Remember when we started, Paul?
Yeah.
So I had already had 6 months of return from overtraining where I was on a really strict 3 times a week, really slow, no intervals. I had just done like once a week interval when we started. And I was about to go to my home country, Finland, for Christmas break. And I was like, well, what should I do? And Paul was like, just sleep, eat good food, sleep, take it easy, go ski when you want to. But, don't stress. How does stress and nervous system tie together? So Dr. Maffetone, if you can explain nervous system, stress, and health and performance.
Yeah, and the autonomic nervous system, as Paul mentioned, the sympathetic and parasympathetic balance, everything is balance, plays an obvious role in training and competition and recovery, which is a big factor. So we have heart rate variability to monitor that. Resting heart rate is a nice indicator too, although you have to be careful because with chronic overtraining, the heart rate is abnormally pushed down. And athletes at some point say, gee, my resting heart rate is lower. I guess I'm doing everything right. Even though they can't get out of bed in the morning. So the autonomic nervous system, so it's really a brain thing. We become great athletes from the brain down. We have to start in the brain, not just in the muscles. And the idea, the concept of stress is often misunderstood. People think it's some psychological thing. It's an emotional thing. Well, it is, but stress can be physical. Stress can be biochemical and metabolic, and stress can be mental and emotional. And actually, the mental part of stress includes education, and miseducation can create a lot more stress than obviously education.
So, Dr. Maffetone, I mean, when you talk about this 4 to 6 month period of slow pace and low heart rate, I'm just thinking about some of my athletes. They would just, that would be, that would, you know, they would go crazy with that. Are you saying that that is, should be something that our everyday athletes should be doing, or is it just for people who have gotten this overtraining or overreaching?
It's potentially for everyone, age groupers and professionals, especially those who have been overtrained, but it's really for people who have not developed their aerobic system. And whether you're a basketball player or soccer or track and field athlete or Ironman athlete, you're very dependent, and even people who don't compete, you know, we're all, as humans, dependent on our aerobic system, which burns higher levels of fat for energy. The aerobic muscles are the so-called slow twitch muscles that have endurance. So the aerobic muscles obviously allow us to train for endurance, but they also support the joints all over the body. And they keep us, they keep the muscles balanced so the joints are more stable during activity. And so the question is, how is my aerobic system? And if it's not great, then you need more pure aerobic training to build that up. Because if you're not purely aerobic training, your aerobic system may not develop as well. So if you do one speed workout a week or one fatiguing weight workout a week, or if you have a lot of stress or you have a lot of non-sports obligations in your life, all that interferes. So the pure aerobic base period that Arthur Lydiard referred to is a valuable thing. And again, we want to monitor that. We want to know, A, are you improving? So if you can run faster at the same heart rate, for example, at the same low heart rate, the MAF test, and you can apply that to a bike, to rowing, to anything. If you are getting faster at the same heart rate, you're improving. And so if you're getting faster and faster as the weeks and months go by, and you're in endurance sports, why would you want to stop that process? Because if you start doing interval training and you start jumping into some races to kind of think, well, I've got to, you know, just kind of race a little bit to get my race thing back.
Can we go back to MAF method? And if you have a new athlete coming to see you, Dr. Maffetone, what is the check engine light for you when you're looking at a new athlete? How do you know that aerobic base is something that they need to work on?
A lot of it is taking a good history. And first of all, I should say I don't do that anymore. But a lot of it is taking a good history. And when I was in practice, I would spend typically 90 minutes initially with an athlete. I want to know all about them. Now, they've already filled out a whole bunch of forms and typically sent them in. Way back then, we didn't have email, but you know, I got some of the basic information, but I wanted to hear a lot of it from them. I wanted to know, how they train. Of course, they'll bring their diary, and I want to know about their competitive performances over time. Their coaching connection, is somebody coaching them? Are they coaching themselves? Is it haphazard? And then I would do a physical exam to measure muscle function, thinking maybe I'm going to want to do some biofeedback, EMG or EEG biofeedback that may help them physically. But then I would send them to the track or go to the track with them with a heart monitor. In the beginning, nobody had heart monitors except me, because I had a cardiac monitor that hospitals used, but the wireless monitors hadn't come out yet. So it was part of the assessment process. And once I was able to assess them on that high holistic level, I can then compare that with their level of health and fitness. And if it didn't match, I had to see, well, okay, it's not matching. If we do these things, you'll be okay starting in a week. And as you train more, we can monitor you and you'll be okay by your next race, as long as that takes. And so the process really was primarily assessment. That's the often the missing link in healthcare, especially today, where practitioners are given an average of 8 minutes to talk to their patients.
Wow. Let's talk about assessments, Phil, in the context of the MAF method. Now, we get this on Athletica sometimes. You can imagine with, you know, we're trying to really scale this whole concept for the world. And a lot of people coming in here doing your MAF method, we see a lot, like as you would have across a career. And, you know, probably just like there's a variation with 220 minus your age for calculation of max heart rate, we have equally this challenge with the MAF method as well. Some will have a very high, you know, they'll be like their heart rate will be super high, and they're kind of your key problematic sort of the people that are having to walk when they're sort of doing this. Likewise, we have very fit, healthy athletes coming in, right? So how do you sort of calibrate this ideal level of, you know, where someone should sort of start with their heart rate that they want to kind of hold on to for a little bit of time whilst they go through periods of time of testing?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, if you spend that much time assessing someone, you're going to find a lot of things that are not quite right. Some of them are going to be more serious, and some of them are going to be just minor details, but there's a lot of things that are not quite right. The big question is, okay, what do we do now? We can't address all of those issues. I tried doing that early in my career and it was a disaster. so we have to be a detective and say, okay, where do I start? What are the primary issues? What are the secondary issues? And we want to address the primary issues so that trickles down and addresses the body is able to trickle down and address the secondary issues. That's the game. And two of those important primary issues high up, three of them, one of them is refined carbohydrates as part of a junk food diet. Another one is the training intensity, so the heart rate, and building that aerobic system. And then the other one is stress. The heart rate problem is an example of physical stress. The dietary aspect is an example of biochemical metabolic stress. But what about those mental, emotional stresses that can be just as bad? And in many cases, people are so used to them that they don't realize that it's affecting them or it's a problem or that they're even there. Mm-hmm. And so, you start here at top and you know, it's like talking about any of these things. And then sometimes the athlete says, well, but wait a minute, I just have a knee problem. That's all they want to focus on. I want to focus on the big picture. They want to focus on their symptom. And I've, you know, in the beginning, when I started using the heart monitor, I realized how therapeutic it was. And I had a runner. He was a good runner. I think he was an age group runner, but he was really, really good competitively. And I got him training, or I got him eating better a little bit. And we had just started with, I think, one visit with specific recommendations. And he had, I think he had a chronic back pain that was often debilitating. And I had left to go lecture somewhere. And I got a call from my office that he had called, and he was in severe pain. And what can he do? And he you know, he was still able to run, and the pain was always there, and it didn't get any worse. But he you know, and we hadn't really gotten him on the heart monitor yet, because the only one I had was the one I had. And so that was in my office. And I left a message saying, go to my office, get this heart monitor. Here's how you set it up. Just run according to your heart rate. And I heard from him when I got back. I got a message when I got back that his back pain had gone away just with two or three runs. Which really makes sense, because your stress level has come down. You're encouraging the aerobic muscles to work better. They're not going to fatigue much, so your functions of those aerobic muscle fibers, which is support of the low back in particular, is going to be noticeably better quite quickly. And so that was an interesting clinical experience for me, to see how powerful that can be. Now, potentially that was just the pattern of back pain he had, but I've seen that before. I'll often, you know, eventually my practice turned into I'm going to ignore everything except for these primary issues. And so people would come in with hip pain and knee pain and all kinds of problems. And I would just say, look, we're going to ignore these things because they're secondary. We're going to treat the primary things, and your body will change quickly. And in many cases, in most cases, that was the case.
I also think math is really useful method in teaching athletes the easy pace. What does it feel to go easy? Because when you start doing the math test, and if your aerobic engine is not humming happily, you will find yourself walking. And it is really difficult to drop down to walking when you think, oh, this should be easy test. This is easy. But if you want to keep your heart rate at that target plus minus one or two, at least I allow myself a plus minus one or two and try to keep it in that range. It can be really frustrating to run like that for 5 miles.
It is, but only because you've come from the no pain, no gain world.
Yes.
And you're thinking, gee, I'm, you know, this is terrible. You know, I don't want anybody to see me working out. I can't train with my friends anymore. I can't. You know, and I would tell patients, train at night. Nobody will see you. but the frustration of running slow is a very common thing. And then over time, as they get faster and faster, they start complaining that they have to run too fast. you know, you get down to a 6-minute pace, which is not unusual. for an age group athlete, if they have the schedule, if their stress levels can be controlled, that's not unusual. Certainly for a professional, that should be easy. And I've seen people, you know, coming down to a 5-minute pace aerobically, which is pretty incredible. So they, you know, they start saying, "Well, I can't run this fast every day." There's a mental component to that, but there's a, you know, the effort factor. There's all kinds of interesting things going on there. However, when that happens, I talk about aerobic intervals, where you train at a lower heart rate for a period of time, and then I like the fartlek workout. So you warm up, you get into your zone. Now, if you're running fast for 2-3 miles, and then it's just kind of intense because you're going really fast. Now you slow down, lower your heart rate, recover for as long as your body wants to recover, and then you pick up the speed again, and do that for the entire workout. That's an incredibly wonderful workout.
Mm-hmm. So
we see that on the bike a lot sooner because the stress level on the bike is different and less. So people get to the point on the bike where they're having a hard time getting to their aerobic heart rate because they're going so fast. And we have to, at that point, we have to look at the bike setup and their gears and make adjustments as needed. But at some point, it's tough. So doing an aerobic workout, aerobic intervals in those situations is very valuable. And likewise for the slow, in the beginning, for the slow athletes, sometimes I say, look, do some downhill repeats. And they say, oh, you mean uphill repeats? No, downhill repeats. So we want you to run down the hill at your aerobic heart rate, which you'll be running faster with the same heart rate. And you'll get, you know, if you don't overstride, you'll get a nice turnover effect where on the flats, you're going painfully slow. And if there's an upgrade, you might have to walk.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Phil, I was just, I've been listening to you, and as you go, there's been a new study that's come out in Norway by Ingvild Odden. It was published, I think it was published in JAP. It was a great study. They've and I just actually got back from Norway, and the sports school system there is just phenomenal. And kids actually go to school to learn sport, and then there's testing and whatnot that goes on, and they actually have to take part in these research studies as part of their courses and all these. So they've got this this group of cyclists ultimately, and they basically every single training session, if you can believe it or not, is like monitored with gases, right? So they're hooked up to the VO2 max cart. Yeah, it's crazy. So, but anyways, they take them through a whole series of interval training, and they post assess what they actually sort of saw from the data. And they look at the responders to interval training and the non-responders to interval training. And of course, you won't be surprised, but one of the key significant findings was that those that adapted and got better with the interval training, they had a higher volume of MAF work that was under them, zone one training. So, and it was clear as day. It was the only statistical significance in the two. So they were able to work out a higher percentage of VO2 max. So there was something in this adaptation energy that's brought on by that low intensity training. So, and the message is if you're just doing HIIT training, you won't necessarily adapt to it. You need to have that MAF training underneath it.
Yeah. It's great to see those papers because, I mean, that's when we first met, but those kinds of studies, that kind of data that's collected is just invaluable. It's the science part of me that I enjoy so much. The clinical part, I don't care what the science says. I'm going to do this because I know it's the best thing for the patient. If they're an athlete, I know it's the best thing for them to improve their human performance. And in the very beginning, boy, I was trashed a lot by the, of course, the whole athletic community, but the scientists in particular and the clinicians too. And something you said that was interesting is that they were measuring gases. And of course, in the paper you and I did on maximum aerobic function, we showed, I can't remember now what graphics we had, but we basically showed that heart rate and fat burning, you know, had a very important relationship.
Totally.
So for people who can't get into a lab or go to Norway, they can just monitor their heart rate. It's kind, you know, these are more of the tools that we should be looking at. The paper we're currently writing, you know, people say, well, how do I know if my brain is improving? Measure your waist at the umbilicus. And if it's getting smaller, your brain is improving because we've made that relationship between excess body fat and poor brain function.
Yeah. Why don't you talk about that paper, Phil? Like, what are the highlights in that one? What's the general thesis?
Gosh, I've lost some brain cells over that paper. and we're still not finished.
Nope.
But we're getting there. It's, you know, I always go through this, not being, a scientist or a researcher, being a clinician is, you know, you write the paper and then you get the reviewers making comments. And I always take the reviewer comments as, oh, he hates this paper. You know, what am I going to do? He doesn't like it. But in the end, the paper turns out better. So I'm always grateful for that. But we basically address the concept of brain health and differentiate or define brain health holistically, the full spectrum of brain health versus how we tend to think of it now, which is, you know, if we don't have memory loss or Alzheimer's, then our brain is okay. And then one day we're diagnosed with Alzheimer's, so we go from a healthy brain to an unhealthy brain. And it just doesn't work that way. And we talk about how that end result of an Alzheimer's diagnosis begins 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years earlier, often in childhood. And there are markers all along the way. And one of the markers being excess body fat because of its significant influence on chronic inflammation, insulin resistance, and how it affects the brain, which has its own blood sugar mechanism and, you know, use of ketones. Again, so the production of ketones becomes important. And then really the bottom line is that refined carbohydrates, including sugar, that allow you to use more ketones in the brain, use more fat burning in the muscles, less reliance on sugar is going to improve the health of the brain. And there's so much involved and it's turned into a kind of a monster of a paper.
You've got the general gist there, right? Is that the processed food and sugar is not going to be doing wonders for, you know, arguably one of our most important organs on our body, our brain, and, you know, therefore your mind. Now, Mariana, I was looking at some of your correspondence with some, some of the Athletica users that they get this, issue. But speak, Mariana, to the struggle that they have on a day-to-day kind of basis with families and these sorts of things. You know the comment I'm referring to.
How not to eat pasta?
Yeah.
Okay.
How not to eat birthday cake.
Oh, birthday cake. Yeah. Well,
and there's always somebody's birthday. And,
yes.
And people go to the birthday parties because they want to eat cake.
This is such a good segue, because like I could almost like I can picture myself reading all of your papers and like just nod ahead, because I've been through them all myself in my experience. And then I read this, The Overfat Pandemic, your book, Dr. Maffetone, and it was such a light bulb moment for me. So all these dots are connecting in my head. Overtraining, too much high intensity, my body breaking down, constantly injured, something. I even had Bell's palsy. And it takes a long time before, you know, the dots start connecting. Thank you for all your academic work and work that you have put on online, and also Prof, your work and your help of guiding me back to health. But when I was in the mindset of this is my Olympics, Ironman Norway 2019, I started gaining weight, and I was, you know, fueling my long rides and long training with God knows what, candy and lots of sugar. And I was eating because I was told, oh, as a woman, female athlete, you have to like eat extra carbs. But then eventually I figured out that this is not the right way to go, because my waist started to just expand. And I'm a muscular person. So if I look at my BMI, I'm, you know, obese, right? Which is, it is not the case. I'm pretty fit and healthy now. So I started measuring my belly circumference, and that started dropping when I started cutting carbs and processed food, especially like not just carb, because, you know, nice, beautiful apple has lots of carbs, and vegetables have carbs. So I'm not throwing carbs under the bus, but processed foods. And reading The Overfat Pandemic was just a good reminder why we should just grab our food off the ground. But with the family, I have three kids and two teenagers now, and they seem to be able to eat all the carbs they want. And one of our athletes was asking, how do you eat healthier? He wants to cut processed food like pasta. And I said, well, you can still make the pasta sauce and then use like squash spaghetti, like use the vegetable or sweet potato and, you know, dump the pasta sauce over that. So there are ways that even busy family moms and dads can, you know, improve their health by going a little bit more natural diet. And your Math Kitchen recipes are wonderful. My favorite is actually your coffee with the egg yolk. This is my morning coffee now. It's egg yolk, half and half. And I put cinnamon in there, or what is the fall spice?
Cardamom?
Cardamom. And it depends on my mood what spice I put it in there. And then a little bit of coconut oil. It's so good. I love it. I love my coffee. So thank you for that recipe.
Thanks. That's I have that in the morning. I use a whole egg, and I use some raw unsweetened cacao. And for people who have never tried this, it's the best cappuccino you've ever had. But yeah, the problem, you know, when you have a family, or if you're social and you're visiting people or having people over for dinner, you know, what do you do? It becomes a stress. You lose all your friends. you know, what do you, I say to people, look, you want to eat the way your ancestors ate for millions of years. And the only reason you have these hang-ups about the socialization of junk food is because the industry that makes these unhealthy foods have been bombarding the world, not just, you know, in the Western world, but the entire world, for generations, mm-hmm. about the importance of having these foods, you know, on every level, even the scientific level, where they teach still that humans are glucose-based animals. Mm-hmm. And somehow they tie that in with the need to eat the refined carbohydrates, whether it's pasta or bread or cereal or, you know. And so it's not, you know, in the paper that Paul and I are just finishing, hopefully, the relationship with the industry and how it how lobbying has changed governments in their recommendations to their people is what got us to a point where 80% of the world's population is overfat. Mm-hmm. This is a very serious problem. You know, people talk about the obesity problem and how many people are obese. But as one of our other papers showed, about 30% of people who have normal BMIs and normal weight still can have excess body fat. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the question for mothers and, you know, guys who like socializing and kids, you know, it's do you really want to be healthier? Mm-hmm. Do you want to make health a priority? You want to make your brain this amazing part of us that creates all kinds of wonderful things throughout life. And our brain can get healthier and healthier throughout life and become the healthiest brain on the day we die. What a concept. But you can't do that if you're eating refined carbohydrates and your body fat is too high. So, you know, it's hard to go against the social tide, but it's a much bigger issue than the issues we talked about earlier, where you say to a runner, you've got to train slow for a while, even though all their friends are training hard.
Yeah, it is. And I would say that it takes time. Like I've seen from my family now that we eat a lot healthier, we eat less breads and pasta, and like it's not obvious choice anymore to grab a toast. But it will take time. Like if you have a family and you want to make the change, just be patient with it. You know, like the kids will pick up and they will see that you're making changes and you're making those choices that, you know, impact you positively. So just try, don't give up if it doesn't work in, you know, like 20 days, but it will eventually change how they eat too. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Maftone, what advice would you give to everyday endurance athletes looking to implement the MAF method into their training routines?
The two primary things that I mentioned earlier, which apply to most people. I've certainly seen athletes who would come in and they're training pretty well and they're eating really well. And so we don't have to address those issues immediately. But for most people, they've got to get off the junk food, which are the refined carbohydrates, including sugars. And then the first thing they say is, well, you know, what about my energy? What about this? What about during a long ride or during a race? You know, and I talk to them about the fact that as they build their aerobic system, their fat burning goes up and they're going to rely a lot less on carbohydrate supplementation during the race. And many of them in a shorter race, they don't use anything but water. So that may help. So first, get rid of the unhealthy food. And then second, get a heart monitor and you know, using biofeedback, find out the status of your aerobic system. if you're only able to run at a 10-minute pace, for example, and you're training 8:30 pace typically every day with your friends, that discrepancy is how poorly your aerobic system is functioning.
Dr. Maffetone, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. This has been fun.
This is a great conversation.
Incredible.
Thank you for listening today to the Athlete's Compass podcast. Take a moment now, subscribe, share, and let's keep navigating this endurance adventure together. Improve your training with the science-based training platform Athletica and join the conversation here on the Athletica Forum. For Dr. Phil Maffetone, Mariana Rakai, and Dr. Paul Larson, I'm Paul Warlowski, and this has been the Athlete's Compass podcast. Thank you so much for listening.
We hope you enjoyed another episode of the Athlete's Compass podcast, your North Star through the sometimes complicated world of training for your endurance sport. We appreciate your comments and training questions and your 5-star reviews. For a deeper dive into the science of endurance sports, listen to the Training Science Podcast and check out the adaptive AI training platform athletica.ai. Thanks for listening.